hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Colin, and my sobriety date is June 18, 2007. So I am originally from a place called Altamuskin, which is in County Tyrone, Northern Ireland. I was born in 1968, the same year as the Troubles started in Northern Ireland. For those of you who don't know, the Troubles are the name, it's the name given to the war between the English and the Irish in Northern Ireland, which really became a sectarian war between the Catholics and the Protestants. So I grew up Catholic in Northern Ireland at the height of that that war. It was a guerrilla war. Irish Catholics had a were the basically had the military end of the Catholic end of things was the IRA, and then you had the British Army and local UDR and RUC Protestant forces. But it was a very weird time to grow up in Northern Ireland because Catholics and Protestants were very much separated in how they lived publicly. I went to a Catholic school. We never mixed with Protestants. We sort of had this separation going on at all times. Irish people, Catholic people in Northern Ireland policed themselves, which means we didn't go to the police if there was a car accident in the community or if there was some kind of trouble. We didn't use a police force because the police force were Protestant and therefore British. So it was a very weird sort of, obviously, to a child, it felt very normal. It's not until much later that any of this seemed unusual. A child growing up in any environment will sort of adapt and accept as normal all sorts of madness, which I did. One of the problems with living in a community that is self-policed like that is that it is also rife for abuse because there's nobody really monitoring, and there's no outside sort of governmental force monitoring what goes on in the community. So the element of secrecy in a community like that can be very harmful. People ask me, was I abused as a child? I think all children growing up in that environment, to my knowledge, were abused. It was sort of part and parcel of growing up. We didn't call it abuse, we called it discipline. Kids were disciplined. We were beaten at home, we were beaten at school, we were beaten at home for getting beaten at school, and on it went. But again, none of this seemed wildly unusual until much later, I guess, as an adult trying to figure out my own issues. Not that I'm blaming my alcoholism in my childhood, I'm not, but I do feel like there was a lot of confusion in my life as far as identity and living in a very controlled environment. I started drinking when I was about 15 really. 15 was the first time I got drunk in a bar. You could go into a bar at the age of 15 in Ireland and order a beer, and nobody would really think anything was very unusual about that. And I was an alcoholic from the outset. It immediately gave me a sense of euphoria. Felt like I had escaped from reality and pain and confusion and self-doubt and all of those things. And I loved it right away, loved it, and had no fear of becoming an alcoholic. The idea of being an alcoholic or a drug addict had always seemed quite romantic to me. And it seemed like a fun sort of way to spend your life, as far as I could see. At an early age, obviously, there was no real sense of mortality to deal with. So it was all fun and games. I moved to London when I was 18 years of age. When I was squatting in North London working construction, things were particularly bad with the Troubles at the time. I knew quite a few families who were involved and started to see where, you know, I lost some people that I knew, young boys who were shot by the British Army, the SAS. Hit squads in Northern Ireland at the time. One particular incident, the Lochgall massacre, there were 8 young boys who were shot by the SAS. I knew a couple of them. I went to 3 wakes in one afternoon. They had the open coffins, and the boys had their faces, they'd been shot in the face. And again, the trauma of all that didn't affect me until much later. I realized at about the age of 20 that it was time for me. I bounced around from London to Northern Ireland, but by the time I was 20 in 1988, things were really bad in Northern Ireland, and I had been arrested with a friend and interrogated. And it became apparent to me that things were probably getting closer to me. So I left. I left home and I moved to New York at 20 years of age. I had a major drinking problem when I arrived here. And then I started doing cocaine in New York, working construction, making amazing money, getting paid cash, living in the Bronx, and partying like a rock star for some time. But I was very aware that I had a problem even then. I had dreams of being a writer. I really wanted to pursue a career of writing, but I had no idea how to do that. I'd never had any training in that field. But I did like to read and fancied myself that I could write. I moved to San Francisco when I was 22, became a full-blown alcoholic, I would say, in San Francisco over the next year, and also probably a cocaine addict at that point too. By the time I was 23, I was in enough pain physically, mentally, and spiritually that I had reached bottom, and I looked for help. I got the yellow pages, and I called and found out where there was an AA meeting, and I got myself to my first AA meeting, 23 years of age. I got sober. I got a sponsor. Started going to meetings, and I moved back to New York, and moved in with a girl who was sober, and We eventually got married, and after the first year of being sober in New York, I walked out in front of a car in Yonkers and accidentally walked in front of a car that was doing about 50 miles an hour in a 30 speed limit zone, and I was spun up in the air. I got hit head on. It hit me right in my kneecaps and spun me into the air. I landed on the window of the car, and I wound up breaking my back in 2 places. I wound up in a body brace, I wound up in hospital, and wound up in a metal body brace for about a year. And immediately that day, they gave me Demerol and then started me on Vicodin for the pain. So for the next 7 years, I was sober, but I was a drug addict. I didn't realize how severely it had become for some time, but I was attending meetings. I started going back to college again at the age of 25. I put myself through college, started taking writing classes and poetry classes, and all the time maintaining a drug habit. I had three doctors on the go. So I would hit three doctors in the same day, get my prescriptions, because I had a valid excuse. I had broken my back, so I was somebody who could get pills very easily, Percocet, Vicodin, whatever else I could get my hands on, Tylenol 3 if there was nothing else around, as long as it had codeine. And I would stay high for a couple of months, dry myself out, and then and repeat. I did that for 7 years. I studied at college. I bought a house in Riverdale. I opened up a used bookstore coffee shop. I got divorced and I got married again. So by the age of 31, I was living a very sedate, drug addicted life and quite successful in Riverdale, the Bronx. And then one day I decided that maybe I should have a drink again, that maybe I wasn't really an alcoholic after all, that I could easily go have one drink, and then if it didn't work out, I could go right back to meetings again, because I knew how to stay sober. So I figured it would be as simple as going out for a drink. If that didn't work, I would just go back to being sober, and everything would go on as normal. So I had a drink, and then I had another, and then I had another, and I was drinking absinthe. I decided to drink absinthe, which I had never tasted. So I drank a bottle of absinthe and decided I was okay, and drove home with the bottle between my legs. And 2 weeks later, I was stabbed buying cocaine on White Plains Road at 2 a.m. And I remember driving myself to the hospital, and I had a plastic bag positioned underneath my arm, underneath the arm I was using to use the stick shift to catch the blood that was running out of my arm. And my thought at that point was, okay, I can't cop there again. Not I have to go back to a meeting, but that's not a good place for me to cop anymore. And that sort of, I think that moment for me sort of defines what alcoholism means to me. I always think about that moment, and I think I had all this knowledge about what it took to be sober, how to be sober, but once I had the first drink, I lost my mind. And I realize now that that's what alcoholism is for me. Once I have the first drink, I don't know where it's going to take me. I was 31 years of age, and I didn't stop drinking or doing cocaine for the next 8 years. I lost my home, I lost the business, all within a matter of months. And by the time I was 39, I had, you know, I'd woken up in a hospital along the way, strapped to a gurney, having no idea how I got there, nurses begging me to go to rehab. I woke up in jail, in a jail cell in Harlem, having no idea why I was there, finding out then during the day that I had managed to smash my car on the FDR the night before and hospitalized my girlfriend and my brother, almost killed a couple of people. And that went on and on and on until I was 39. I was living in a walk-up apartment in Hell's Kitchen. An old Italian guy who liked to drink with me had given me this apartment to live in, and he thought I was highly entertaining as a drinking partner. And he basically would overlook the fact that I didn't have rent money. So I was living in Hell's Kitchen, and I had gotten to the point where I was drinking. I couldn't stop. I'd reached the point where I realized, you know, I'd heard about it before. It's never happened to me, I think, until probably I was 36 or 37. By the time I was 39, I was somebody who really, really, really wanted to stop drinking, but I couldn't. My liver was damaged, so I could feel my liver was swollen, and I could see my liver. I was down to weighing 115 pounds. I couldn't eat solid food. I looked like a crack addict, and I was hustling money on cigarettes on the street. And I would wake up in the morning and I would drink vodka. I would throw up. I would drink some more vodka, and to try and stop the shakes. It wasn't about being drunk anymore. It was about trying to normalize my thinking, because without a drink, I felt insane immediately. If I went 4 hours without alcohol in my system, I would start shaking. So I slept with either whiskey or vodka beside the bed, so that when I woke at 3 or 4 in the morning hallucinating, I could easily lift a glass and start drinking again. And the hallucinations did happen. I woke up with the devil in the room. I had rats on the bed, all of that wonderful stuff. I was paranoid. I was being followed by the CIA. And it seems insane to me now, but that's where I was at. My friends came to my apartment. My one friend, Tony, eventually came to my aid and took me to his farmhouse upstate New York to dry out. That was in 2006. I dried out for a couple of months. I wasn't going to meetings. I just was drying out. But I really was not quite finished. And I took one of his cars one day, and I drove myself to some local country bar and started drinking again. And within a couple of days, I was busted by the cops again. The cops were following me out of a local village. I was drunk. They arrested me, and they took me to jail. I got 2 months in an upstate jail, something that I'd done a few days here and there, but I'd never done time. And that was an amazing moment, to be walking into a jail holding a pillow and some sheets and having people yelling at you and realizing, oh my God, I am no longer free. I'm a 39-year-old man who has nobody in the world who trusts him anymore. And I am alone. I don't have a partner. And I've let everybody down, and now I'm in jail. And that's where I was, 39 years of age. And I didn't stop drinking. In jail, I met a few head cases just like myself, and I learned how to make jailhouse hooch, and we got drunk and stoned on pills in jail. And then when I was released, I was on probation, and the first night I was released from jail, I drank, I smoked weed, and I did cocaine, knowing that the probation officer was going to come to my house within a week and piss test me. And it went on like that for another year. And I also, at that time, I have to say that when I was in that farmhouse, I started to write about my drinking. I started to write the story of my drinking life. And about a year later, I had about 70 or 80 pages of this book written, and I was in a relationship again. I was back in Manhattan, and one Sunday morning, I woke up and I was sitting in the bed drinking a tall can of Foster's because I couldn't get out of bed without a drink. And it was a beautiful Sunday morning. The sun was shining. And all of a sudden, the light bulb went off. And I saw myself for who I really was. And I realized I was an alcoholic. It just dawned on me. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it finally dawned on me that I was an alcoholic in that moment, and that I could never drink safely, and that who I was somebody who built my life around drinking and alcohol and everything that it done to me and everything that it took away from me. And I decided that day that I would quit drinking, and I got up the next morning, and that was June 18, 2007, and I quit drinking that day. I knew it's a funny thing. I'd been in and out of recovery for 22 years, but I'd never fully understood what it was to be an alcoholic until I understood it, and I understand that about myself now. I was very ill. Even after quitting drinking, my liver was damaged. I had nervous system damage, so my hands would shake for about a year and a half. And I craved alcohol every single day for 18 months. And then one day, the craving disappeared. And that was the most amazing feeling. And I no longer crave alcohol. I finished writing that book. I found an agent. My agent got me a book deal with Random House, and I published the memoir of my drinking years called Orangutan. It was published in 2009 by Random House. 3 years later, I published a second memoir about growing up in Northern Ireland called That's That. I also had a daughter at that time with my third wife, who I had married in sobriety. We have a beautiful daughter called Erica. She is now, she'll be 9 this month, and she has never seen me drunk. I am no longer, the marriage did not last, but we do have a beautiful daughter. And then in 5 years ago, after much therapy and soul searching in sobriety, I met somebody that I really love, a beautiful woman called Rachel, and we got married, and we now have a son, Samuel, and he's about 19 months old, and he's crazy and beautiful, and it's just amazing to have two children who have never known me drunk. We live in a really nice house in the country. I made my first feature movie, loosely based on my own life, called Emerald City. There's a trailer for it on YouTube. And that movie has been playing in film festivals for the past year, and now I've just been hired to write and direct another feature movie called Flogging Maggie for a guy called Kevin Fortuna, who wrote a short story called Flogging Maggie. And my life has changed dramatically. What to say about my sober life? Oh, I have friends who are drinking, and I see them drink, and it breaks my heart now, because I realize that alcoholism is probably the most selfish of all. Addiction, alcoholism, it all seems to stem from pain. It all seems to be, I think a lot of it is self-medication against childhood trauma or abuse, or confusion about identity, who I am in the world and where I belong. And then, of course, you get trapped in the drinking cycle, and that becomes an identity, and it's easier to live in that identity than to go through the catharsis of abandoning everything you know about yourself and embarking on a new journey. But that is really the only answer. And all I can say is the one thing that I don't do, I do go to meetings sometimes. I went to a meeting last night. The one thing I would say about being sober for me is the one thing that I never do and have not done in 10 years is pick up a drink and put it in my mouth. As long as I get that one piece right, I will never be drunk ever, ever, ever again. And as long as I'm sober, I am an active participant in this madness, in this life. It's, you know, I have no idea what's going to unfold, but I'm present, and I feel like I'm doing my part now. And life's not easy for anybody. I have my own problems. I still have moments of self-doubt and depression and all that stuff, but it's just life. Crazy beautiful life. And I can say this thing, this about myself. I have a gratitude list that I do with two friends. I've been doing it for a few years now. It's an email chain, and every single day we email each other a list of things that we're grateful for today. And that has been an amazing tool for me, because every single day I am forced, even on my worst days, I'm forced to look at my life and say, I am grateful for this. I'm grateful for the health of my children. I'm grateful to have a roof over my head. I'm grateful to have dry clothes. I'm grateful to be sleeping indoors. And there's always a list of things on my worst day that is still better than my drinking life, and that's amazing. And one of those things is peace of mind. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. So after that Sunday morning, when I realized with my can of Foster's that I was an alcoholic, I actually said to my partner at the time, who became my wife, I said that I was going to drink all the alcohol in the house that Sunday, and then the next day I would not drink again, and I would get help. So I did. I drank all the alcohol in the house. It didn't seem to have any effect on me anymore after something probably psychological, the fact that I knew that I was done. And the next day I got up, and miraculously I didn't have a hangover. I went to a meeting that afternoon, an AA meeting, and I started going back to meetings on a regular basis. I got into therapy, and I think partly my recovery has been a mixture of meetings, therapy, delving into my childhood, and my writing. My writing really was instrumental, especially the second memoir, that's where I started writing about my childhood. I didn't realize what my childhood had been or who I was until I went back and looked at all that stuff. Gabor Mate says that he never met an alcoholic or an addict who was not self-medicating against some kind of pain or trauma. And I really believe that in my own life. I have yet to meet an alcoholic or an addict who has not some kind of trauma that there's medication needed for. And in my case, it meant me going back and looking at my childhood and saying, okay, this is what happened. This is where I was in that situation. Here's who I am now. And sort of dealing with that pain that had been neglected for 20 or 30 years. And that was probably the most important part of my recovery. I still go to meetings. As I say, I was at a meeting last night and heard exactly what I needed to hear. And it's not that I go all the time, but the first thing that I tell anybody who wants to quit drinking is, if you want to quit drinking, go to a meeting, get your ass to a meeting, get a sponsor, work the steps, spend a year or two doing that. If you decide after that you don't want to go to meetings, do whatever it is. It's going to keep you sober, but go to a meeting and try to get some kind of structure, some kind of help, and some kind of a social group around you who are going to sort of help you along that path, because it's not easy. It's not an easy path, but it gets easier and it's worth it. The one other thing that I do now for myself that has been instrumental in my mental well-being is yoga. I started after I met my wife. She's a yoga instructor, and I'd been hearing about yoga for a long time, and finally decided, because of her and seeing how it affected her life, I decided to go give it a shot. And I do practice yoga now, and that has been amazing for the mental, physical, and spiritual part of my life. It sort of ties very easily into a spiritual way of being in the world. And, you know, on top of that, it really helps me feel good. Yoga has been great thing for anybody to do, but especially in recovery, I find.